It was lovely to come and sit today. After so much busyness, I'm sure I'm not the only one that's been really busy these past weeks. Did anybody notice the silence? Yeah. You know, even with, you know, the sounds of the traffic and people arriving and little rustlings and the sound of the heating system, around that, you know, if the mind can just be quiet for a little bit, you can notice that there's silence, you know, around the sound. And it was lovely. I just want to read, I'm going to be quoting a couple things from this book, Awareness, by Anthony DeMello. He was a Jesuit priest in India, died in about 20 years ago, I believe. He was definitely a maverick, and a matter of fact, I think he was ended up being kind of condemned by the Vatican for his radical views. He was very much influenced by Buddhist and Hindu teachings. And at the beginning of this retreat he was giving, he said, "You're ready to listen. And mind you, being open does not mean being gullible. It doesn't mean swallowing whatever the speaker is saying. Oh no, you've got to challenge everything I'm saying. But challenge it from an attitude of openness, not from an attitude of stubbornness. And challenge it all. Recall those lovely words of Buddha when he said, 'Monks and scholars must not accept my words out of respect, but must analyze them the way a goldsmith analyzes gold, by cutting, scraping, rubbing, melting.'" So I would hope that you will listen to this talk in that spirit. And I'll talk until I'm done with what I have to say, and then we should have some time at the end for you to offer your experiences with what I'm going to be talking about, and also to ask any questions about what I have to say and challenge what I have to say with openness. And so, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, when I was on a 10-day retreat with Gil at Jikoji, which is a Zen retreat center up off of Skyline. By the way, is there anybody who's here for the very first time tonight? Ah, welcome. Welcome. Okay. So I was at this retreat, and Gil did a series of Dharma talks, one talk each day, and what he talked about were what he called the 10 steps in the process of simplification. And I found it very helpful. I didn't find out until the end of the retreat that actually what he was describing as the process of simplification, what he was actually talking about were the 10 fetters, which are the 10 factors that bind us to samsaric existence. Now, samsara is the opposite of nirvana or nibbana in the Pali language. So samsara is this world of passion and attachment to people and things and all conditioned things, and the continual birth and death that happens as a result of that, and the suffering, minor suffering and major suffering that creates. A fetter means literally a shackle for the ankles or feet. It's kind of an old-fashioned term. I think it's been used in terms of prisoners, that they would shackle them in fetters, and also with cattle, that they would shackle their legs so that they couldn't move very far. So a fetter is a restraint that confines or restricts freedom. In this case, we're talking about the fetters that we create in our thinking mind. The fetters are also some of what are called the defilements. Now, people that are new to Buddhism, you probably don't realize yet that the Buddhist teachings are full of lists, and the 10 fetters are just one of these many, many lists. And it was for good reason. It was because the Buddha's teachings were not written down until, I don't know, hundreds of years after he died. So his teachings were passed down strictly through oral tradition. So they had to have ways of remembering all of these various teachings. So, you know, there are the three poisons and the four noble truths and the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. But this is the ten fetters. And this Patricia Walsh Frank, in an article on compassion, she was saying that in the Buddhist doctrine, we are called upon to free ourselves from the defilements of the samsaric world, which arise because of our ego consciousness. A central notion of the egocentric person is that he is, in some way, the center of the universe, and that the things of this world are his. He sees himself as an independent ruler of his life and as a powerful person who has some control over the impermanence of all things. Believing in his power, he also believes he has a right to ownership of the things of this world, just as he clings to these very beliefs themselves. His attitude is concerned with the satisfaction of one's own desires without consideration, oftentimes, of others. Well, that kind of describes the human condition. You know, during the first few years of our lives, they sometimes refer to as the birth of the self. During those first years that we develop this sense of being this separate self, this body ego, which is, it's a normal stage that we go through, and not so many people get entirely beyond that stage. So this Buddhist list of the ten fetters comes from the Samyojana Sutta, which is a part of the Anguttara Nikaya, or the numerical discourses. These are the discourses that are arranged in order of the number of things in the lists. Okay, but today I'm going to talk about the first fetter, which is belief in personality or self-identity view, or taking things personally. I'm just going to read through the list of the ten, but I'm just going to talk about the first one today. The second one is skeptical doubt, particularly doubt of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Three is attachment to rules and rituals, and then sensual desire, ill will, craving for material existence, craving for non-material existence, conceit, which is judging and comparing oneself with others, restlessness, and ignorance, particularly ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So at that retreat at Chukoji, Gil described the first fetter as taking things personally. He pointed out that freeing ourselves from this fetter is just the beginning, just the first step out of ten, but it's such a major undertaking. Most people never get beyond that entirely. So, you know, in this process of developing this body ego as young children, we each come to see ourselves as the center of the universe. And we believe that everything revolves around us. And then when it becomes obvious that it doesn't, we take it very personally. It can feel like having it our way is a matter of survival. You know, that's generally the cause of the mighty tantrums of the quote, terrible twos. You know, it really can feel like a matter of survival. That's why the two-year-old just kind of, you know, falls apart and kicks and screams and when things aren't going their way. They're starting to learn very painfully that maybe the world doesn't revolve around them. So this is the personality view, or identity view, the first fetter. I really dearly love going on retreats. I highly recommend it to anybody who can get away, even if it's just to come here for a full day of a retreat, or to go on a weekend retreat, or I highly recommend longer than a weekend, because when you go on a weekend, those first few days are generally the hardest days. When you're tired and sore from sitting so much, and the mind is just going like crazy. So the retreat practice is a great opportunity to observe this first fetter and all of the others also, because we're not so preoccupied with all of the daily business and busyness of our daily lives. And also because the retreat setting generally creates a much greater sense of safety, partly because there's really nothing you have to do, none of your usual responsibilities. You know, you're not reading the newspaper, you're not hearing the news, you're not having to answer the phone, you're not watching TV, you're not having to do your usual work. So, plus, you have the support of all of the other retreatants and the support of the teacher and the little short interviews that you have with the teacher. So it's easier to focus on the ways that we keep ourselves in bondage through our own thinking, judging, and comparing. Here are some examples. Particularly in my earlier years of retreats, I'm getting beyond this now, but you know, there'd be this kind of this in the back of the mind, these sort of little thoughts that would flit through, like, you know, I walk silently in the meditation hall. And unlike some people, you know, who go clomp, clomp across the floor. I eat slowly and mindfully, and I don't put my elbows on the table. And I sit like a mountain, you know, not wiggling all around. Or conversely, I have the worst monkey mind of all, and I need remedial work and concentration and mindfulness. I remember telling Gil that I needed remedial work and concentration. He didn't care for that. He thought that, you know, this is just part and parcel of the practice. But I still believe that I have a harder time with the concentration than many people. But, you know, it's all about I, you know. I've discovered that as long as I indulge in these sorts of thoughts, you know, I have no chance of becoming concentrated and truly mindful, or developing enough concentration that the mindfulness can become true insight and vipassana. And then no chance of experiencing the accompanying states of joy and equanimity and happiness, you know, just unconditional happiness, and let alone finding liberation from suffering. It's just not going to happen if the mind is busy with all of these judgments and comparisons and the conceit and all the I thinking. And then there's the, you know, then following up on that is the whole idea of mine that goes along with I. You know, this concept of mine, it's all about possessiveness and greed. My car, my house, my clothes, my children, my opinions, my rights, you know, my, mine. And on retreat, it's especially easy to observe these attachments and to see how they cause us suffering and stress. On a retreat, it might take the form of my space in the meditation hall, my walking path. You know, on a retreat, you alternate the sitting meditation, like 45 minutes of sitting meditation and then 45 minutes of walking meditation. So, assuming it's not raining or really terrible weather, you go outside and you kind of find a place where you just walk or pace back and forth, and just paying attention to the sensations of in your feet, you know, the sensations of walking. But, you know, typically you find a certain place and you walk back and forth, and occasionally, for some reason, someone will come and start walking in your space. You know, you're going this way and you turn around and here they are walking in your space. You know, it's my space, my walking space. It wasn't 5 minutes ago, but now it is, you know. Or my turn in the shower. But it can also infiltrate the spiritual practice itself. You know, my peace and tranquility, my concentration, my enlightenment. My enlightenment. That's an oxymoron. You know, it's not possible to achieve enlightenment, awakening, liberation through this sense of I, you know. I remember on one of my first retreats at Vajrapani Institute, which is a Tibetan retreat center up deep in the Santa Cruz Mountains near Boulder Creek. And I got there that first afternoon wanting to get there early enough so I could get a good seat in the meditation hall. I went through this stage where it was very important to me to be seen. At first I thought it was because I wanted to be sure I could see, because for all those years of childhood going to church, I was little and everybody'd stand up and I couldn't see anything. So it was really important for me to be up in front, you know, and I thought it was so that I could see the teacher, you know, when they gave their talk. And then, with great chagrin came to realize somewhere along the line that what it really was is I wanted, especially Gil, I wanted him to be able to see me. I needed to be seen because I wasn't yet seeing myself properly, you know. And I knew that Gil and other teachers also, but that he would see me properly. So I get there to the meditation hall and go to put my cushion there, and all the front row spaces were taken, you know, and then the teachers were up in front and people were in the front row. So, okay, so I put my stuff in the second row, and then I left. And when I came back for the first sit after dinner, everybody gathered in the meditation hall. Of course, other people had come in and put their things in. And someone had taken my mat with the cushion on it and pushed it right up directly behind the person there in the front row. And then they had put their stuff right behind me. And but meditation hall etiquette says that you don't move other people's things. So, you know, when I saw that, they weren't yet there, I couldn't move their stuff because that would not have been proper. So, and then besides that, it turned out that this person had back trouble. So through in a lot of the sits, they would lie down during the 45-minute sit, and then they'd fall asleep, and then they'd snore. So I sat there just seething through the first few days of that retreat. It was a 10-day retreat, and it was terrible, and it was wonderful, because what it did is it gave me the experience of taking it personally, you know, what this person had done, that they had done to me, taking it personally, and then feeling the tension and the constriction and the burning that went with that indignant anger. It was a really powerful learning for me. And after, I don't remember how many days, and after seeing what it was doing to me, I didn't want to do that to myself. So then I was able to start letting it go and just accepting this is how it is, okay? And then I could find more and more the peacefulness and the happiness that were just there waiting for my attention, that are there beneath all these incrustations of all this ego stuff that we've built up over the years. I remember saying to Gil once, I think it was on retreat in one of our interviews, you have a little 15-minute interview with the teacher. Depending on the retreat, it's typically every other day. Some of Gil's retreats, it's almost every day. But I remember saying to him, you know, I feel like I'm somehow in my life, I'm holding myself back somehow. You know, it's like this. I was saying, it's like this. Something's holding me back. And he said, what if it's more like this? You know, kind of, you know, oh. Yeah, so I had myself in shackles or fetters, all in the way that I was thinking about things and the judgments and the comparisons. This is a very important point about working with the fetters. It's not about gaining something. It's about letting go of whatever's not needed or helpful. And then what's left are the lovely qualities that come with liberation, unconditional happiness, love, compassion, equanimity. It's all there. It's all there within us. It's just gotten covered over. is from the verses on the faith mind by Sang Tsan, who is the third patriarch of Zen. He said, "When the thought is in bondage, the truth is hidden, for everything is murky and unclear. And the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. What benefit can be derived from distinctions and separations?" It's not that thinking and discernment aren't sometimes helpful and necessary. It's just that probably about 90% of our thoughts and judgments are not helpful and not necessary. And because they take the form of moralizing, pride, comparing, craving, or just this repetitive self-referential thinking. And all of that for the purpose of trying to shore up this fragile, precarious sense of self. It is burdensome. On the early retreats that I went on, after I would get back from the retreat, get home, I would write about the retreat. And this was what I had written after one of the retreats. "The physically and mentally rigorous schedule on retreats has led me to see how I create my own homegrown stress and suffering in the form of fear, anger, physical pain, and attachment to comfort. I've gotten to see more and more clearly how this big ego operates, and to begin to, quote, dismantle the ridgepole of the edifice of self," unquote, to use the Buddha's metaphor. I love that, this idea of, you know, the ridgepole. I guess that's kind of the main support pole, like in a big barn or something. To dismantle the ridgepole of the edifice of self. "So much of my fear and anxiety has been really a form of pride, the fear of being humbled." That was really hard for me to see that, to realize. You know, it didn't seem so bad to be have this fear, but when I realized it was really pride and conceit, that was yucky. That took a lot of work to let go of really harshly judging myself about that, you know. As one of the great Zen masters put it, I believe it was Suzuki Roshi, he said, "No self, no problem." Yeah. The less I cling to this self-image or this identity that I worked so hard and long to create, the less tension and anxiety I feel. This has freed up so much energy. That's something that is just remarkable to me about this practice. Is that when I first started the practice, I really didn't have much energy, and so I would resent having to do things because it just took too much energy. And somewhere along the line, when I started letting go of this, the conceit, performance anxiety, it just freed up so much energy. You know, I can do so much more now. Yeah, and I say that I worked so hard and long to create. That's because of many years of therapy that I went through before ever starting this practice. And a lot of the therapy was about building and developing this strong sense of self, you know. And then finding that, okay, now I got to start dismantling it, you know. That was just the stage. It was, I think, a necessary stage, but it's limited. There's a ceiling, you know, as far as how far you can go with this strong sense of self. So these are some of the signs that I've discovered over the years in my daily life that are indications that I'm in fetters or shackling myself. This is one that I've pretty much let go of now, but I didn't have road rage. I had more like road indignance. You know, somebody would cut me off or, you know, cut in without signaling, or I'd see that they were, you know, going 65 miles an hour. They were really tailgating, or, you know, they just do something stupid. And so first there'd be the initial fear when they cut me off or something. And then immediately after that would come this indignant, outraged anger. You know, how dare they? You know, they should know better and all of that. And then I would watch them as they went on down the road to see what else they were going to do wrong. You know, I could keep myself in this state of, you know, just this constriction and the tension that went with that anger for a good period of time. And then after doing this practice for a while, I started using that as a practice, and I would start observing what it would do to me when I would continue to watch this person, and I would just feel this tension in the gut and in the chest, and it was, I didn't want to do that to myself anymore. So now, yeah, somebody cuts me off, there's the moment of maybe panic, then there's a moment of anger, and then it's like, let it go, you know. It wasn't hurting them, my watching them. You know, they didn't know. It's only hurting me. So, you know, I just think it's so helpful to just watch ourselves. And the body, I think, to use the body as the key, to watch what our mind states and our emotions do to us physically. You know, raise the blood pressure, the blood vessels constrict. Like I said, it saps our energy, and all kinds of various diseases they are finding are due to, at least partly, to stress and the tension. And I think a lot of that comes from this attachment to this sense of self. So she mentioned that I'm a therapist, and you know, I still remember one client who came in and. He said that after a few sessions, he said that I was his least favorite therapist that he's ever had in all his years of therapy. You know, and he'd had a number of therapists. And you know, at first I took it personally, and then I realized, no, not to be taken personally. Yeah. Same thing with my husband. We've been married 38 years now, and he has this tendency to snap about stupid little things. And then, you know, it used to be I'd get hooked every time, you know, and I'd snap back, or I'd just withdraw and hurt silence or whatever. You know, I'd be taking it very personally. And then somewhere along the line, I realized that this is just what he does when he gets anxious or stressed, you know, and I'm the one that's safe and I'm the one that's available, and not to be taken personally. So it's just so much easier now for me to just let it pass. Or, give him a little bit of time and then come back and respond to him from a more adult sort of state of mind. Okay. Anthony DeMello, he's quite a character. Very different from my personality, but there's something about him that delights me for some reason. He said this, "A young man came to complain that his girlfriend had let him down, that she had played false. Well, what are you complaining about? Did you expect any better? Expect the worst. You're dealing with selfish people. You're the idiot. You glorified her, didn't you? You thought she was a princess. You thought people were nice. They're not. They're not nice. They're as bad as you are. Bad, you understand? They're asleep like you. And what do you think they are going to seek? Their own self-interest, exactly like you. No difference. Can you imagine how liberating it is that you'll never be disillusioned again, never be disappointed again? You'll never feel let down again, never feel rejected. Want to wake up? You want happiness? You want freedom? Here it is. Drop your false ideas. See through people. If you see through yourself, you will see through everyone. Then you will love them." I love that, you know. We can see through ourselves, then we can see through other people. We see through all that crap, you know, all these incrustations of protective stuff, you know, that we've gathered over many, many years. You can see through that, then you can love them and love yourself. And then he said, "It's probably too startling for many of you to understand that everyone except the very rare awakened person can be expected to be selfish and to seek his or her own self-interest, whether in coarse or in refined ways." Ooh. There was a Buddhist nun, Aya Kema. We have a few of her books here in our library. I believe she was born in Germany. She died some years ago. She put it a little more politely. She said, in the Buddha's cosmology, there are 31 levels of existence. The human level is fifth from the bottom. What is to be expected here? We're really not very evolved as a species, you know. We are not the pinnacle of evolution. I used to avoid giving talks like the plague at the agency where I used to work, and then I've given some talks at the San Jose Sangha down in, near Santa Clara University. There's a small sitting group down there. I used to get so nervous before giving a talk, and now I know that it was all about pride and conceit and that fear of being humbled, you know, and if I make a mistake or if I don't do it good enough, and I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but mostly I think what would happen is that I would really get down on myself. That's what I came to realize. So there's still some of that. You know, I haven't entirely pulled up the roots of all of these various weeds, mental weeds. But, you know, I find that I keep cutting them off, and they're getting more puny, you know. So Anthony DeMello said, that still leaves us with a big question. Do I do anything to change myself? I've got a big surprise for you. Lots of good news. You don't have to do anything. The more you do, the worse it gets. All you have to do is observe and understand. What Gil said on that Jokoji retreat, he said, you don't have to work at letting go of the desire and clinging that create suffering and get in the way of liberation. Just trust the practice, trust in awareness, and when you see clearly enough, whatever is not helpful or needed will naturally slough off like a snake sloughing its skin. It's a process of simplification. I find these instructions most reassuring. That's what I had written after this retreat. We don't have to deliberately work at letting go of any of this. It will happen naturally if you keep doing the practice consistently, persistently, not here and there, now and then. I've done daily meditation almost consistently through this whole 12 years, plus going to the San Jose sitting group once a week and the Monday night sitting group once a week and going on the retreats. It's a lot of effort and, you know, a major commitment. But it's not about sitting here and then trying to make something happen. It's a letting go. Just like you can't make yourself go to sleep at night, you know, you have to be able to let go in order to relax enough to get to sleep. Just one more little thing that DeMello said. I highly recommend this book, Awareness, Anthony DeMello. I'm sure you can get it cheap through Amazon. Okay. This is where he's talking about how to approach this practice of observing and changing. He said, a dog trainer attempts to understand a dog so that he can train the dog to perform certain tricks. But a scientist observes the behavior of ants with no further end in view than to study ants, to learn as much as possible about them. He has no other aim. He's not attempting to train them or get anything out of them. He's interested in ants. He wants to learn as much as possible about them. That's his attitude. The day you attain a posture like that, you will experience a miracle. You will change effortlessly, correctly. Change will happen. You will not have to bring it about. So I'll just end my part of this, and then I would welcome other people's experience with, how you have shackled yourself, or, the fetters, or maybe you observed in others. It's probably easier to observe in others. And then also any questions that you have about this talk or about the practice. DeMello wrote many dialogues between the disciple and the master, and this is one of them. So the disciple said, "How shall I get liberation?" "Find out who has bound you," said the master. The disciple returned after a week and said, "No one has bound me." "Then why ask to be liberated?" That was a moment of enlightenment for the disciple, who suddenly became free. Well, didn't happen that way for me, and for most of us, it's kind of this gradual process. Occasionally, there are people who have this sudden awakening, generally people who have suffered greatly. I don't know if any of you have read The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. He's one that suffered enormously through the first, about 30 years of his life. It was deep depression, high anxiety, to the point where he had become suicidal, and then in one night had this sudden awakening. So that's what I had to say. I'm just interested in any thoughts or, maybe experiences that any of you have had that this reminds you of, or any questions. We have about almost 20 minutes, and so we can talk and have discussion, questions, and then if there's time left, we can have a little more sit. Yes. Oh, just a second. I guess they have to.
How many hours did you put into meditation? You said you meditated routinely every day for past 12 years. How many hours a day?
How many hours a day?
How many hours? Within the last 12 years. Exactly.
Typically, I would try to do 45 minutes, just like we would do here. Well, I guess in this one you do 30 minutes, but typically, like on retreats or in the Monday night sit, the Sunday morning sit, they do 45-minute sit. I haven't always done 45 minutes. Certainly there are times where if I can do 20 minutes, but really, if you can do 10 minutes or 15 minutes, that's certainly better than not doing it at all. Gil has said, just at least just get your butt on the cushion, and if you say, "I just don't have time," well, just sit down, and if you only, if you jump right back up, well, at least you've sat. And you might find that once you sit down that, well, maybe you do have a little bit of time after all. Yes.
I wonder how much sitting in or practicing is just like practicing. I mean, sort of akin to an instrument. You're kind of practicing your instrument. You're trying to, I think control the mind is quite the right word, but become more aware of habits of thoughts, and it just takes time. It just takes time. And it takes, if you've ever played an instrument, it just takes time, and takes time every day. It takes hours every day to be skillful at anything. And usually it takes, I was reading someplace, anywhere from 5 to 10 years to be adept, to have skill at any one thing that you've put your attention to consistently at. So if you're studying engineering or studying anything, it takes a while. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you were to take piano lessons. So you go once a week and you get your lesson, and then you go home and you don't practice during the week. Nothing's going to happen. Yeah, right. It needs to be that daily practice. And even with, you know, doctors or therapists, we talk about having a therapy practice or a doctor having a medical practice. Yeah, I'm still practicing, you know, always learning from my clients, you know, learning from my mistakes, learning from, yeah, more from my mistakes than successes, I guess you could say. Yeah. Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I don't know who it was, one of the great meditation teachers who said that with the meditation practice, to consider yourself a beginner for at least the first 10 years. This really is a lifetime practice. Yeah. So I've been doing it for 12 years. I no longer feel like I'm in kindergarten, you know. But I don't know, I don't feel like I'm at university level yet. Yeah. What else? I don't know if any of you new people have enough courage to speak up and say, you know, what this has been like for you or what brought you here or any questions, if you already knew anything about this Vipassana or insight meditation, or if you just happen to be walking by, or I guess that is how some people end up here. Yes?
When you said that humans were really low on the rungs,
yeah.
I'm not at all knowing what all those other things were above.
All I know is that I know that there are the beneath humans, you know, there is the hell realm and the animal realm and the realm of the hungry ghosts, which is, you know, all about greed and never getting enough, and the human realm. Then there are all these heavenly realms, but I don't know. Some say that, and I've come to believe this, that we can experience all of these different realms just in our daily existence. That, you know, like this experience that I had on the retreat where I was just full of this anger, you know, that burning. I was in the hell realm, you know, at that time. Or that hungry ghost realm, I'm sure we've all experienced that at times where you just, there's just so much longing or desire for something and you just can't seem to get enough, kind of that addictive quality, whether it's, you know, chocolate or alcohol or the internet or, you know, some people actually get into that with the spiritual practice. It can become addictive.
I think your talk was very nice, and when I came in, I kind of was relating to you feeling a little bit, you know, you have the papers, and I've had to give a few talks sometimes, and it's that kind of... But I realized the wonderfulest thing is when I'm talking about something that doesn't have anything to do with me, and I just go, I don't exist. I'm just getting this information out, you know, for the farm workers or against the war or whatever. It makes it so easy. You, like, that's no self, I think.
Nice. She stuck you with the microphone. you don't have to, you can always pass.
I believe this may be more about myself. I have been, for the last few short years, working on clearing my mind of the monkey voices. And at times they get very powerful. But what I've learned is when I'm driving, I I don't believe I've turned the radio on once or twice in the last 3 or 4 years. I can clear my mind just by driving. And coming back from San Francisco today, I was here. I just left. It was rather amazing. And I just look far ahead, and I can see everything around me. Watch the traffic, but I just clear my mind and breathe. And it works. It's amazing.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful
practice. All the little monkey voices, and I'm terrified about a lot of things, and I'm learning to get past them. I would like to talk to you more when this is over. Speaking of walking meditations, the monkey voices caught up with me about 2-3 weeks ago. And the only thing that I could do, I spent quite a while, a week or two, sleeping nearly none. And this one night, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, it was just so much going on, all I could do was just stand up and walk. And from about 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock till about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, I just walked around my house. Mm-hmm. Just walked and walked and walked. Mm-hmm. And it was good. It was the first few minutes was kind of bad, but then it got to the point that it was just automatic. I didn't bump into anything. There was no lights on. I just kept walking and breathing.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when a person is really highly agitated or anxious, the walking meditation can be more helpful than the sitting. I remember going through a period when I was in the process of leaving the counseling agency and going into private practice, and there's just a lot of stress going on there in the agency, and there was just so much mental agitation that I would sit down and meditate, and it would just seem useless. That was the practice. But that's when I learned Tai Chi, which I found to be extremely helpful mindfulness practice, because with that, if you don't stay focused on your movements and then you lose your balance and you lose your place, and whereas with breathing, you're going to keep breathing whether you're paying attention to your breath or not. So that really helps me to get through a difficult period. But I can see we're walking also.
I did this inadvertently, but now I see it's really beneficial.
Yeah, great.
I was just going to note that at times it's easier in a way, walking meditation, where for whatever reason, engaging the body with the breath and just very slowly, methodically, one step after the other, it really reduces the monkey brain for at least for a while, but then it comes back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the ego, to this self-identity, the ego, it feels like death to not pay attention to all of this, the thinking and the thinking and the thinking. Can be scary.
I'm not quite sure I put this, but in the world that we live in today, and especially for me at work, everything's on the computer. And there's just so much information to process and so much information to remember. And I find that there's an expectation from the people I work with, administrators and everybody, that our brains are like computers. We're supposed to remember all of this information. There's just so much information. Mm-hmm. And so with this practice, trying to let go, of all that stuff in the head, it's really a conflict because there's so much I have to pay attention to at work. And then I do my practice every day, you know, the meditation where I'm trying to let go of all that stuff. And it's really, it's like I don't want to, it's almost like what I have to do at work really conflicts with what I'm trying to do with my practice, and it's hard, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know quite how to...
It's hard to shift gears. I mean, the anxiety is really detrimental to practice, or vice versa, the practice that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where I would highly recommend getting away on a retreat, you know, where you can just put it all aside. Don't have to do anything. If they say nothing to do, nowhere to go, no one to be, just for that period of time, you know, or even to just come here for a all-day Saturday sit. But yeah, there is this, that need to be able to shift gears, kind of like in Tai Chi, where there's the back and forth, the yin and yang, the constriction of muscles that's necessary to move, and then the relaxation, you know. So it takes a lot of practice, the shifting gears. Yeah. But yeah, this society certainly does not support the quiet mind. No.
Leading on from what she said, I'm a builder, carpenter, contractor. And when I it just happens. And I get so into the monkey voices and the things going on and trying to solve them and trying to keep track of it and keep going, it gets more confusing. What I have found when I let it all go and quiet myself, and then I come back in a quiet way, I can just do all the things I want to do, fix all the things I want to fix, line everything up, because I have a stillness of mind. But when it's all confused, it's like scrambled eggs. You just can't separate it. You can't figure out the different parts and pieces. So quieting myself, I have found, is where it works. I'm still trying to figure out how to do it, but it does work, and it's helping out a lot just to quiet myself.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully just gradually we'll be able to do it more and more often.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we have this be the last question, and then we'll just take a minute or two just to sit.
Okay. Well... Let's see. Okay, everybody says that, but this thing about not taking things personally, you know, that you were talking about earlier, and that's a thing I have to contend with, because I'm also in a work in a field where I have to deal with the public, and sometimes people, just strangers, come out of the blue, and like they want to. Oh, they want to have me come and do some kind of work, and then sometimes all of a sudden, at the drop of a hat, they change their mind. They don't want to do it. And that kind of thing is the kind of thing where you really have to, the more you can get so you don't take these kind of things personally, you know, I can see the benefit of that. And so that seeing how this practice can lend itself to getting out of the fetter of taking things personally, I can see the benefit of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think this is very helpful, what you've been saying to us today about that.